Okay. So I was asked by Michael and Jean to steer a discussion on geometrical complexity or characterization of fault zones, and I'll do it with the help of a few slides. Does anybody here have a laser pointer? Okay, fine. So it's good to start. I'm starting this with actually a schematic diagram that you see on the left. And on the right you see actual faults, both in nature as well as in laboratory experiment. But I'd like to begin with this schematic diagram that shows what I would call fault zone at different scales. Okay? So here, maybe we look at the fault zone from space. Okay? So this would be a plate boundary scale. And on a plate boundary scale, perhaps the entire western US, all the way from, this is the coast of the Pacific Ocean, so all the way from offshore to somewhere in the basin and range, this entire region can be considered to be a fault zone on that sort of plate boundary scale. Now, motion in this fault zone, of course, is not distributed uniformly, and there are a few elements here that we will focus on that, that carry more of the load, and in particular, the San Andreas, which is the line right here, carries about 35 millimeter per year of motion out of total of maybe 50 millimeter that are distributed from here to here. So if you zoom in on some of those big members, we again, you maybe are dealing with what I would call as a fault zone scale, okay? So this would be a fault zone scale. And then of course, the width here may be, let's say 1 kilometer. We can zoom in further. And if you zoom in further, if you just focus on, let's say, one big localization region within the fault zone scale, we are now in, let's say, the fault zone gouge, or maybe a better term would be the slip zone, okay, scale. And now this is a scale of maybe 1 millimeter. Okay, so now in each of these scales, one can identify several elements that actually are repeating on all of these scales. For example, we can find that there are some lines here that within a given resolution appear to be roughly Euclidean. They're not completely straight, they're not completely planar, but there are some lines, certainly there are lines that are relatively straight. Okay, so there are some elements here that I will refer to as Euclidean because they're relatively planar. And you can see them on all of those scales, all the way from here, as well as within the slip localization. So there are clearly inner lines that are linear. Okay, so that's one type of element that we can identify in all of those scales. Another element that we can identify in all of these scales is some elements of granularity or blockiness. So if you start from this scale, it's obvious what it is. These are just grain rock particles that we heard several talks on this. They could be very small. It could be nanometer. It could be larger. And on the biggest scale, the grains could be as large as the plates themselves. So the plates, there are 12 plates on the surface of the Earth. These are mega grains, if you want. Okay, so we have some Euclidean elements, we have some granular elements, and the third type of geometrical features that often you will find in the literature are fractals. So you can do all kinds of measurements here or here. You can count particle size distribution, okay, you look at some roughness of the whole area of or of individual segment. I will actually show you data. We will go quickly. So this is a schematic diagram, and then I have a few other introductory figures, and the rest will be just data. So you could, you know probably, and you will see that also the language of fractal comes into play. So no matter on all of those scales, we can describe them using with some approximations, using Euclidean geometry, using fractal geometry, and using the language of granularity or blockiness. Now, so there maybe are three very broad frameworks that we can use. These are names that perhaps, these are just names that I picked because they convey certain mechanical implications. So maybe they are not ideal names. But from this schematic diagram that I showed you, you see that there are actually three broad ways to characterize and to discuss fault zones. So the first framework is what I would call continuum Euclidean, which consists of primarily Euclidean surfaces. They don't have to be continuous, they don't have to be entirely smooth. but Euclidean surfaces within a continuum solid. This is one framework. Second framework is granular, and the third framework is fractal. And the reason I choose these terms is because each of these terms carry very different mechanical implications if we really take them at face value and ask what's the implication if it's truly, let's say, fractal. So in a continuum framework, continuum Euclidean, basically we expect, the bottom line is we expect all fields to vary smoothly. That's the key. And this, this is an example of what you get. This is an example of stress transfer calculated in elastic solid by some dislocation surface somewhere here. And what you see are changes of stress, but basically it's a smooth field. It varies smoothly. And the other thing is it sort of varies everywhere in space. There is no macroscopic anisotropy here. And it implies certain correlation lengths. So within the continuum Euclidean framework, we don't expect fields to be correlated, let's say, 10 times larger than the size of the Earth's rupture. So, okay, so that's sort of basic continuum Euclidean framework. In granularity, on the other hand, in granular framework, the fundamental structure is very different. It's actually discrete and strongly heterogeneous. And these heterogeneities cannot be averaged out by some kind of coarse graining. It's an important part of the picture, of the mechanics, and it leads strong macroscopic anisotropy. And what you get are pictures like this. You're all familiar with this, right? So what happens is here we get correlations that are far, far larger than, let's say, the size of an event. It goes to huge distances, but it's anisotropic. So on some, in some direction, let's say if you think these are block boundaries in the Earth, along the boundary, fields are correlated over very, very large distances. You go across them, they die very shortly. And the third framework is fractal framework, and I just picked here a picture. It's a mountain. This is what I would consider a fractal geometrical object. And here we have roughness. I'm skipping some details because this is just, I really want to show you data. But basically here, it's rough and discrete and heterogeneous on all scales. And if we really take it at face value, differential calculus and basic concepts that we are using to describe the formation like stress and strain don't have well-defined meaning. If in fact the scales here, Mark talked a little bit about this. The question is, what's the lower bound? As soon as you tell me that there is a lower bound, then it's okay, I can deal with it. But if it's truly fractal, we don't have right now, we are not talking with the correct mechanical frameworks. So the question is, and this is my job, right, to steer a discussion, but what do we know actually from data? This was just an introduction. So to answer this question, we can just go and now look at data. What do we know from observations? And there are different kinds of observations, okay? So these are categories of observations. We can look, for example, at surface fault traces in exhumed faults or end exhumed faults. We can look at just surface traces on the surface of the Earth as well as in exhumed faults that came up. In general, geological study. This would be one type of study that will give us some information. Then we can look at inversion of geophysical data from structural velocity models. It gives some information. We can look at hypocenter distributions, and what's the geometry of the hypocenter distributions. And finally, we can look at laboratory data and also mechanical predictions. I will not show you all of this. As you can see, there are subcategories in each of these. Basically, the subcategories are divided by resolution. So depending on the studies, there are different types of resolutions. I will show you only examples that are associated with the highest resolution example in each of these categories, first of all. And the other thing, that the other distinction that is made here is that it's important actually to distinguish whether the data come from regional, whether there is a selection of specific sites, or do the data come just from a regional study. And the reason that this is important is that as soon as you go and you select a particular site, you just study one segment, there is the potential danger of a bias. That maybe the result that we are going to get will be limited or will be biased by the site selection. So this is quite different than, let's say, I'll show you a hypocenter distribution, so you'll see what I mean. It's quite different than just looking at the entire regional data and then let some geometrical features emerge from the data. It's kind of a different story. Right, or versus picking a particular segment and looking just at the hypocenter distribution on that segment. So we will do both, but it's important to make those distinctions. Okay.
I think Yehuda, are you entertaining? If you can go backwards, Well, why you're putting resolution on the order of a kilometer for the
for what?
Topic one or section one.
No.
What?
No. Here it's sub-millimeter.
Sub-millimeter.
As I said, there are different resolutions, and I will, because many, depending what you do, I'm not giving you everything that people did with surface stresses, but there are lots of studies that have resolution of the order of kilometers or less.
Yeah, there are a lot of data.
I will not focus on them. I will
meters to hundreds of kilometers.
Right, yeah. So I'm not going to focus on them.
Okay.
All of this material, by the way, much of this is taken from a review paper by myself and Charlie Sammis. If you want all of this, it's in the paper. But here, I will just give you examples, and I will tend to focus on what's outlined here in red. I'll show it in bigger font in a second. And these will be just the highest resolution studies from each categories. Okay? But yeah, you'll see. There are different resolutions. We'll go over this. So let's start with geological studies. Okay? And this is a map of some faults, not all of them. You'll see more later. From Southern California, basically, I'm showing you here the Punch Bowl Fault that Jim Rice talked about before. So in general, the San Andreas Fault migrated over its geological time. It started in the ocean, and it moved eastward, northeast, and today it's right here. And some people are claiming that it's actually migrating further to the east, and the Eastern California Shear Zone is an effort for the San Andreas to migrate. But there are some very large structures that are no longer active, but they used to be the San Andreas a million years ago. And one of them is the San Gabriel Fault right here, and the other one is the Punch Bowl Fault right here. Jim showed results of particle size distribution from the Punch Bowl Fault. I'll show you some geological maps. There's some overlap. Okay, so the Punch Bowl Fault is a big fault, that's the point. It actually carried 44 kilometers of slip. So it's not a small fault. It's no longer active. And this is a map. This is a geological map of the Punch Bowl Fault at a particular location at a given mapping resolution. Resolution is always important. So here is a scale. It's 2 meters. And if you just look at this, it looks very complex on first blush. Okay. However, you already know the story about the Punch Bowl. It turns out that virtually all the 44 kilometers of slip is carried by a zone that is maybe 1 centimeter thick. So there is a lot of complexity around here. You could do, for example, fractal studies. People have done fractal type analysis of all of these branches, but it turns out that these branches are all passive. Part of the story here will be that when you start, that's the hypothesis that I will try to develop as we go along, is that when you begin to deform a rock, at the beginning you create a lot of complexity. And then early on there is localization surface. And so if you try to measure the slip across all of these faults, it's very small. It's 0.5 meter at most, usually less, centimeter. But this guy right here carries several tens of kilometers. So there's a very, very big difference. Okay, so here's a blow up. This is a map at even finer resolution. This is now 5 centimeter. And so this is the slip localization zone right here, and this is the principal slip surface, which in this case is on the side, sometimes not everywhere. Okay, so this, the Punch Bowl Fault is the exposure. There are several sites that these authors have been studied, and the sites are separated over a length of about 10 kilometers. And not all the features, I will just focus on features that are consistent along all of those sites. So what's consistent is that always you see extremely localized structure, and it even contains as a surface, which they label principal slip surface, that carried virtually all the slip, caused the Punch Bowl Fault. And you see damage and complexity around it. Oop. Okay, so this is the model. This is the model they came up with. And basically, you have damage zone on a scale of maybe 500 meters. This damage zone contains 200 meters to each side. It contains a slip localization zone, which is on the order of tens of centimeters, which internally contains even smaller zones and single surface, principal slip surface that maybe has a width of 10 grains that are nanoscale.
Yehuda?
Yeah.
Just for sake of discussion.
Yeah.
The assertion that I hear being made whenever anyone discusses the Punch Bowl Fault,
right,
is that all the slip is on that one surface.
Right.
How do we know that?
I'm
looking at that map there, and I see some granite intercalated with the sandstone, it looks like. and then there's what they call orthocataclasite.
Yeah.
And the assumption is that there's not much slip going on.
That's right. I don't know in detail, Jim, but there are different rock types. The punch bowl fault separates sandstone on one side and some metamorphic rock on the other side, and they just mapped the slip. They basically did the best they could on many different scales of the slip, and they concluded that all of it, they can go all the way to that surface. So they don't see differential slip as they go from far away. That's the conclusion. You don't see it on this scale.
But when you go to that scale.
Yeah. So when you go to this scale, you see lots of fractures.
But right there in the middle of the right hand side, right there, that's labeled as a granite cataclasite.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't occur naturally in sandstone. I mean, one person might, I would assume that was brought in by faulting from some distance, for example. And so
it could be brought in by some faulting along the punch bowl fault from 10 kilometers away. There is 44 kilometers away.
So there might be 10 kilometers
but this
guy's
out
right there.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I cannot defend this picture in detail. All I'm telling you is it dies out. You cannot trace this. There are inclusions, all kinds. I know Ori, my student, is working there as well. There are lots of localized things that you can find out, okay? But basically, the slip appears to have been accommodated. The large scale slip caused this zone. There is some damage here, obviously.
I just think it's worth.
It's worth commenting that
it's maybe not well established that 44 kilometers of slip have occurred along that 1 centimeter zone.
I think
that there's been a lot of slips there. I mean, okay. But
they've always been vague. I think in written work, saying several kilometers, 44 kilometers on the punch bowl, but several kilometers on this PSS. Yeah. So
it's there's a lot of stuff going on there.
Okay. We won't worry. We won't argue about this further. In some of the publications, they have been studying this fault since about 1984-5. There are many publications. In some of those publications, they claim that virtually the entire slip of the punch bowl fault occurred across this tens of centimeters zone. The numbers vary. So, but this is just extreme localization that carried a large amount of slip. Maybe there is some slip also absorbed here. But similar structures actually were found in other faults. Okay, so I have a list here. I'm not going to show you results, but St. Gabriel fault seemed to also show extreme localization in some places. Incidentally, so we'll zoom out later. Right now we are kind of looking in. If you zoom out, you'll see regions of complexity, of course. These regions of complexity tend to have broad damage zones, etc. But along the San Gabriel faults, the Kern Canyon fault, it's another big fault, and also some small faults in the Sierra Nevada, in all of these faults, you see extreme localization. And the fact that you see them all the way from these faults that had a total of 1 meter of slip, so these faults that had tens of kilometers of slip suggest that this localization occurs very early on. And we will see this also in laboratory experiments. So you start deforming, and in the initial creation of damage, maybe at 100% strain or 200% strain, you already get extreme localization. And then the hypothesis is that this is quasi-passive. It's not totally passive. And for example, it's very important to some topics. For aftershocks, it would be important because they will be activated here, small events. It's important for fluid migrations, etc. But for the large-scale motion, we will argue for now. But my job is to steer discussions, so interrupt. And this is the hypothesis. I'll show you that. So here is Chalenko. This is a very old paper by Chalenko, 1970. And it's really an interesting paper because it appears in the literature. People are quoting this paper to say exactly the opposite of what Chalenko tried to actually emphasize in his paper. So let's first go, what do we see here? So you see the scale. These are results from laboratory experiments with mud or clay of the formation structure. It's 10 millimeter the scale here. This is a rupture zone of earthquake in Iran that sometimes I remember how to pronounce and sometimes I don't. Right now I don't. Ashar el Bayat, something like this. Okay, so this is 100 meters. And what Chalenko actually tried to emphasize in his paper, what he argues, is that in all of those scales, what he sees is a similarity at the different scales of early structural evolution toward localization and simplicity. In the literature, you will find this picture in Chris Schultz's book, for example, but also in many papers, as an evidence for fractality, for fractal structures, because we see complexities that look similar at different scales. But Chalenko emphasized exactly the opposite. What he said is, in laboratory experiments on those scales, and we'll see this later in experiments, in other experiments, what he argues is at the beginning you get creation of some complexity, but then early on, when you get to the peak stress, actually, on the stress-time curve, there is a localization structure that's being formed, and then the rest of this stuff is abundant, it's quasi-passive. And there is something going on there, it's not entirely passive, but it's quasi-passive, okay? So that's the point of Chalenko. This is now,
Can I just ask, when you talk about the fractal analysis of such a network, people have similar problems with river networks, where it depends a lot on whether you weight each branch of the river by the flow, volume, cross-section, or whatever. Or you just look at whether or not there's a river.
Exactly.
And so here, and this it would matter whether you're looking just at, is there a crack, or what was the slip along that?
Absolutely.
Crack.
And here I think it may be even more similar. But it's a very similar problem. There is a network out there, but much of it is quasi-passive, is rarely activated. It's the same with the rivers. And much of the motion appears mechanically to be accommodated along extremely localized regions.
Has there been a systematic attempt to do the fractal dimension by slip distance?
No. There have been some efforts on hypocenter distributions, which I'll get to later, to try to separate. So if you look at the hypocenters, we will see there is a network of hypocenters. We'll get to this, but no, I'm not aware. There are no good studies on this. So it's really, often there is mixing of passive, active. There are also no clear analysis of errors, etc. Okay, so here is...
It's a good point, Mark. It's just slip isn't always so easy to measure.
I ain't saying it's easy. I'm just... But here it's important, it seems, in these other network systems, you look at veins in your ear, etc., too. It turns out to be absolutely crucial. You get two dimensions, if you just look at the veins, that is, there's a vein close to within some distance of every part of your ear. But if you weight by the amount of fluid flowing in the veins, you can actually get a fractal dimension.
Concerning this weighting by the amount of slip or flow or whatever, there is actually this beautiful study of the Landers earthquake by Sowers and others who went out and did map slip on every fault they can see, and their map, if you look at it in the original, has beautiful gradations of line thickness which tell you where the slip was. And yeah, you could say complex of all scales, but when you start to look at carrying the slip, there's really systematic features in the complexity.
And if you remind me at the end, I will show you in the case of Landers, and I'll show you also contrasting example before we get there. But for the case of Landers, I'll show you that when you get 2 meters below the surface, you just dig a trench, that is 2 meter, much of this complexity disappears.
Well, we can debate that.
I'll show you some pictures in...
Because there are branches on Landers that split by kilometers.
No, I know this, but there are branches. We'll get to this. We're gonna zoom in and out in this talk. But within a given branch, there is damage zone at the surface that is 200 meters wide, at the surface. But the paleoseismologists dig a trench because this damage zone. To study, have dark trenches, to study the recurrence of ancient earthquakes. And it turns out that if you go 3 meters below the surface, instead of 200 meter wide damage zone, everything collapsed to a millimeter along some of those branches. But there is this problem, it's a real problem, that when you zoom out, I'm not arguing that we don't have this complexity, we're gonna do this, zooming in and out. Right now I'm zooming in. So now we are looking at now a principal slip surface. This is taken, you also heard about it in the past from Jim Dietrich, I guess. Jim mentioned this. The other Jim mentioned the patch ball. Between them, they mentioned most of what I'm going to talk about. But, okay. This is work of Power and Toulis, and they measured roughness of faults. These are actually small faults. These are faults in the basin and range that had slip of about 500 meters, a few hundred of meters. So compared to the patch ball in San Andreas, these are small faults. And what you see, measurements of roughness in the direction perpendicular to slip and parallel to slip. Okay, so it's clearly anisotropic. And what you see is that in the direction perpendicular to slip, the roughness, which is actually this amplitude here of the roughness divided by the wavelengths, follows more or less on a straight line, in other words, it's power, on a straight line on this Knobloch scale, and it has some amplitude, whatever that is, 0.01. That's in the direction perpendicular to slip. The direction parallel to the slip, what you see, this is the figure right here, that it follows this parallel distribution only up to about a millimeter, or even less. See this? And then there is sharp drop in the roughness. Okay? So I'm saying this is evolving toward Euclidean. The roughness is two orders of magnitude less, and it's clearly not following power over a broad range of scales. So in the direction, and many people measured roughness on specimen in the lab where you just fracture rock. So if you fracture rock and there's no slip, it's self-affine fractal. If there is slip on the fault, what you see is in the direction perpendicular to the slip, it still follows parallel distribution of roughness, but not in the direction parallel. So there is some smoothing going on a single fracture surface. So now we zoomed in, now we're going to zoom out, and we are looking at results from Vesnotsky that also were mentioned in the past. And these are just maps, strip map of strike slip faults in California. This is the San Jacinto fault with about 30 kilometers of slip, 24 kilometers of total slip. This is the San Andreas. And basically, Steve argued that this is now a fault zone scale, scale of 10 kilometers across the fault. There is smoothing going on also, okay? So this, if you make some measurements, I'll show you what he did. He measured the density of offset per unit distance along strike as a function of total slip along the fault. This is what he got. It's a decreasing function. So on that scale, also we have evolution to geometrical simplicity. So now there are problems. This is my geological, this is the first category, my geological field study. And what we saw is that we see evolution toward simplicity or smoothness, but there are problems. Two problems. First of all, maybe these results, this is also all at the surface, so they may not represent in situ condition at depths. Okay? But if anything, we expect things to be more complicated at the surface, actually. We know that as we go down, I already mentioned it, things get simpler. So that's good, that's okay. But still, there is a problem. Maybe there is a bias. This is what I mentioned at the beginning. All of these studies are done on you're making some selection, and we really have to accept the possibility that maybe this selection, you know, if it was incredibly messy, geologists don't agree with this. They like to study messy objects. But we have to accept, since these are all done on particular sites, maybe there is some bias right there toward the simpler structures than I showed you. So we are not going to stop here and move to other categories of studies that don't have this bias. So the next thing we're going to do, we're going to look at inversion of geophysical data for velocity models, structures, beneath the surface. There are many different ways of doing this, but it turns out that most of them actually don't help us. For the simple reason, I'm telling you right away, they cannot measure this sort of small length that we're talking about. So the standard methods are tomography, and you can measure gravity. These are nice things because you measure things on a region. There's no bias. You measure the whole thing. You make some mapping of, let's say, gravity anomalies or tomography in the whole region. And what typically is shown in all of those studies is that some anomalies, there are anomalous regions that are concentrated around faults. But the resolution is just not enough for mechanical studies. Typically the resolution is on the orders of hundreds of meters or worse, kilometers. Okay? So they really cannot resolve the kind of localization surfaces, small scale features, which could be rough, that we are interested in. So can we do better? Not really a whole lot. We can do a little bit better if we actually focus on signals that are generated solely by damaged rock and also by some interfaces here. So I will show you. It turns out that in some faults, large faults, San Andreas would be one example, actually separate two different rock types. And when you have a situation like this, there is a wave that is refracting on the interface between the two different rock types. This wave would not exist if we did not have fairly sharp interface. Now, if you ask me, what do I mean by fairly sharp? I cannot quantify it entirely, but the roughness must be not more than a few centimeters. It really has to be sharp to get this kind of phase, refracting phase, propagating larger than that, along an interface. So we observe these phases in some places, and I will show you this together with some hypocenter distributions, which is going to be the next category. So this is really a new new study, and it's on the Bear Valley section of the San Andreas Fault, which is near San Juan Batista. So it's kind of on the opposite side of the creeping zone of the San Andreas from Parkfield. Okay? So it's a region of the San Andreas Fault. And these are accurate relocated seismicity. Okay, so the relative error between the dots here, each dot here is an earthquake, the relative error is about 10 meters. And the first thing you could see is that this is the San Andreas. The hypocenter collapsed to a fairly narrow bend. It turns out that the width of the bend is within the resolution, the error. So it's probably even narrower. In fact, the existence of these waves, these are the waves, this is the phase that is refracting, tells us that we should have very sharp interface. But not everywhere along the San Andreas, there is a region here, I'll show you later, we'll zoom in. There is actually complexity even here, which persists to depths, we know, because we have the hypocenter distribution. So first of all, let me spend a minute here on this, explain to you the head waves. So if this was a homogeneous material, the seismogram would start with this phase. This is a P wave right here. But what we see is that there is another wave coming earlier, and there's a particular move out or time difference which follows a very simple formula here that can be used to quantify the velocity contours. And the other interesting thing is this formula tells us that if I have a station at a given location, the waves should propagate a certain distance along the fault before the head wave becomes first arriving. And we see this as well in the data. So we know that the San Andreas has a sharp interface. It's fairly it's fairly sharp. It cannot be really rough. It would not support such a phase. Now, these are the hypocenter I showed you before, and these are some of the waves. It's actually beautiful phases coming in, but there is a region right here that we see with the relocated seismicity. It's not totally localized. In fact, there are two strips. This is a map view. We're looking from the top. And it turns out that these two bands of seismicity actually persist to depths. So here is a composite picture of what happens in the Bear Valley section of the San Andreas. And this is the band of seismicity right here. You see that, and I'll show you another figure of this, a blob figure. But one of those, what you see in the map view, one of these strips is actually seismicity at a given depth range, from 3 kilometers to whatever, 6 kilometers. And then the other one is actually on another on it jumps. So these are actually seismicity at different depth sections, and they are offset the depths as well. And it turns out that there is a reason for this. There is a sliver of granite which we can image. So there are two material interfaces in this particular location. But there are other places. So this is something that Alan Needleman asked when we had the original conference, whether the complexity that we see at the surface persists to depths or not. So in this case, it does persist to depths. And there are additional cases that I'm aware of, Parkfield is one, that some double bends at the surface actually persist to depths. But in most cases, it doesn't. It's generally correct that what we see as we go down is somewhat simpler, but not always. Okay, so I showed you very quickly, I went to geophysical imaging, and the problem is that most of them don't actually image the mechanical structure. They give us some image of the damage done around it. So they don't give us really information for mechanics. The only exception, potential exception, are those head waves, but head waves are exceptional. They require the existence of material interface, which is a feature that you don't find along most of the faults. It exists only along the largest faults. So we cannot learn a whole lot from geophysical imaging. So the next thing is hypocenter distributions. That's, we can look at all of them. And again, there are lots of, so this shows the issues of resolution. There are lots of studies that people have done in the past on fractals. They argue that the seismicity resides on a fractal network, but they use routine catalogs that have very large errors. So it's questionable whether this result is correct or not. In the last 15 years, new techniques for locating earthquakes produced much better images of seismicity. And what I showed you from the Bear, and now seismicity can be located sometimes to within a meter, actually, relative location, within a meter, by doing some iterative process. So this is the picture I already showed you. This is from the work with Jeff McGuire. Here is, it's a bend, but here we see two bends, and if you look at it as a function of depth, this is depth now, this is a map view. steps. This is distant topping method default. You see two localized strips. They are sitting actually on opposite side of a sliver of granite, which is mapped at the surface. If you look at the geological map, you will also see two lines right here. So here's an example that complexity at the surface persists to depths. This is another example of relocated seismicity on the Calaveras fault. So this is what you get from standard catalog there. This is the Calavera fault. There are some interesting structures here off. That's a map view, and here is a depth section. This is depth and perpendicular distance to the fault. But here is the image that you get when you relocate the seismicity. So it really collapses to a far narrower structure, also in the depth section. The collapse is to a zone that is several tens of meters, which is really the error in the location. Okay, so, but it's not, again, not entirely planar, to stress Dietrich's point. There are some structures here. There are lines. And here also you could see sort of. And remember that we are focusing here, again, on specific segments.
Do you have the view of that, though, looking at the downward projection? Because you really see those streaks at the surface extinguishing at fairly shallow depth.
These ones?
Yeah.
In this case?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't have it here. But in the case I showed you with the work with Jeff McGuire, it does not distinguish. And I have example from the San Jacinto fault, where there are two very big offsets, two step overs, very big. In one of them, we actually see the seismicity going through it. So the offset at the surface does not penetrate. But in the other, again, we see double beds. So
it's just while that picture's up there, I think it's worth maybe pointing out that it's very characteristic. I think this picture is generally characteristic in that there is a lot of off-fault seismicity. So the total amount of slip involved on those little faults that are producing all that salt and pepper pattern off the fault is small, but they are stressed and they are working.
Sure, but the amount of slip there is very, very small. So these tend to be the small earthquakes.
So these are just points for every hypocenter,
every hypocenter
regardless of the magnitude of the earthquake.
I'm not showing you the magnitude here. So what really happens is the largest faults, only the largest faults, carry the largest earthquakes.
And they would eventually be located in the central region.
They will be in the central region. They will not, yeah. And they will be even, this is a branch of the San Andreas, actually. The Calavera fault is a branch of the San Andreas. So it's a branching network. The spine is the San Andreas. The biggest earthquakes, magnitude 8 or so earthquakes, will occur along the San Andreas. And then smaller earthquakes will occur on all of these branching stuff. The further you are from the spine, the smaller the event is, but it's true that if you look at the map of seismicity, you'll see earthquakes actually everywhere. And I'll show you some.
I think
we'll look at the regions.
Historically, earthquakes, I don't remember the exact number, but they've been compiled, at least kind of for illustrative purposes. Historically, I think more than half of the earthquakes that are magnitude 6.5 or less have occurred on faults that were not even known. You know, they were off these main spines. So there can be significant.
Sure.
But it's certainly true.
6.5 and less. The point is that you are correct.
Which is a fault with this one slip.
In the last, the Southern California earthquake catalog for the last 30 years contains something like 300,000 recorded earthquakes. And of course, if we increase the density of instruments, this number will jump from 300,000 to a million. And 99.9% of these 300,000 earthquakes are very small events. Out of these 300,000, 10 or 15 are larger than 6. Only 2 or 3 are larger than 7. Okay, it's just that, you know, so most of the seismicity are very small events. And that's kind of, but the bigger ones, the bigger the events are, the closer we are to the spine of the network. So here's a region now. This is Southern California. I just took it from just one paper. This is by the group of Peter Schirar. This is Southern California, and now you see this. I told you at the beginning, the system of subparallel fault. This is the San Andreas right here. Right here. This is the San Jacinto. This is some fault offshore. I forget what it's called. San Clemente, I think. But no, we are now zooming out. Before we looked at things like this. Right? And now we are zooming out, and you see there is some branching structure out there, maybe. Now, what is interesting is the San Andreas all along the portion that sustained big earthquakes is actually devoid of seismicity. This is the place that does not have seismicity. And it goes all the way to the Bay Area. No seismicity, or very, very little seismicity with the available resolution. So there is these faults tend to have very big earthquakes. They are relatively geometric. They are geometrically regular. So they get big earthquakes. They don't leave very large stress fluctuation or stress concentration. Then between the big earthquakes, they're relatively quiet. It takes a long time for the stress to come back. In the meantime, the entire network is constantly active. So we have in faults that are geometrically complex, we constantly have stress concentrations that produce more damage and more earthquakes, etc. So that's the picture.
You might point out that on that section of the Mojave segment and going up into the Carrizo Plain, the average slip there in 1857, the last earthquake, is 5 meters.
Yeah, right.
So
Large. This is magnitude 8 plus earthquake. And now it's very quiet, as you can see. But this is very active. What is really active is the Eastern California shear zone. This is the Landers. These are aftershocks of the Landers earthquake. This is the San Jacinto fault. That section that broke in 1857 had average of 5 meters of slip. It's very quiet in the last 100 years. There's almost no microseismicity.
But the broad activity you pointed to might not mean nothing, because after all, the Bay Area was active in a broad sense before the 1906 earthquake. There were lots of...
I did not understand. Might not mean...
Sorry, this is a poor construction. But I mean the broad scale activity in the Mojave might be signaling that stresses are approaching the highest they've been on the southern...
They might.
7 years.
They might. I'm not saying... These are data. What I'm saying is that there is a partition. The places where we get the biggest earthquakes tend to be relatively geometrically regular, and they don't have a lot of microseismicity unless they creep. And where we get all the ongoing microseismicity on regular faults is actually off the spine of the network. But of course it tells us that there's processes going on. Here, by the way, is this better for you, Jim, or should I go
back? No, I'm just curious what the colors matter. Maybe you could explain them.
It's taken from paper that they try to estimate something that is shown in color. I'm not going to tell you what it is because it's not one. I took it for the epicenter locations. So here is the Eastern California shear zone. This is the Landers that Jim was talking about before. Yeah, there are lots of ruptures here, but I can dig a figure, and in the surface, geologist map damage of 200 meters, but as I said, paleoseismologists see in the trenches that much of the slip is really concentrated in very, very narrow zones. But it's obviously geometrically complex. It sort of jumped on this. Yeah, so I'm almost done. This is this category, and the problem with hypocenters is, first of all, they don't image all the structure, right? They image really the places that nucleate earthquakes. And so maybe actually the hypocenter gives us a bias toward complexity. There may be lots of smooth areas in between that don't produce hypocenter. So if anything, I'm arguing the picture may be simpler than what you saw. Okay? All right. What about lab data? That's my last category. So I already showed you some lab data. This is Chalenko. I'm just putting it again because it's lab. So what Chalenko showed...
Is that really lab? I'm reading the scale. It says 100 meters on top. But what's the bottom one is lab, the top one is...
This is the earthquake in Iran that sometimes I remember how to pronounce. Okay. But these three are lab experiments in... Say it loud.
It's Ishtabayez or Bayez.
That's one way of pronouncing, but it's not the correct pronunciation. Okay.
Would you give us the correct
pronunciation? I sometimes I remember it. Ashat El Bayez. I don't remember right now, so that's why. But Chalenko emphasized that in all of those scales, from the field to the lab, there is localization very early on. And this you will find, as I said, in many publications as evidence for fractality. He emphasized the opposite. Here is another laboratory experiment. These are acoustic emissions. So you already saw this as well before. So what is measured is stress strain curve and acoustic emissions at different stages. So A, B, C are different stages along the stress strain line. And what you see in general is that there is a phase with distributed deformation. Acoustic emissions occur everywhere. And then there is a phase of localization, which actually starts here. These are different views. This is, you look from the top, from the side. So all of these phases are distributed deformation inside the cylinder, but at some point we get localization. So it's compatible with the result of Chalenko, right? There is this, and also with what I argue happens, may happen in the field. There's distributed deformation, we go up the stress strain curve, and then there is peak stress, we get localization, and then this is all become abundant. And in the last portions, the acoustic emissions are localized along the surface. And of course, now you created the surface, so you can continue, you may just as well continue and make friction experiment. So this is this figure from experiment by Dietrich, Bigal, and Samis. In 1987.
Wrong order.
Who was the first? I have it here.
Beagle.
Okay. So I should fix it. It's Beagle et al.
It was done in my lab.
It was in your lab, right?
Yeah.
Right, that's what I said. Yeah. So we heard about this before. I'm just showing you some data here. So the experiment is that you take what we refer to as sorted. Huh? You take granular material that has some size, particular size, and you start shearing it. And then what they measure two things. They measure the frictional response and the evolution in the particle size distribution. So what they found out is that after 10 millimeters of displacement, or whatever, 5 millimeters, after a short amount of strain on the order of 100% or 200%, there was an evolution from peaked distribution of particle size to parallel distribution of particle size over some orders. And together with this evolution in the particle size distribution, there was a transition in the frictional, right, and set frictional parameters from velocity strengthening to velocity weakening. So what is happening here, it's similar to the previous laboratory data that I showed you. There is an early deformation phase of distributed deformation, that the whole, everything is active, and you fracture grains. And you fracture grains, and there is evolution in the particle size distribution. But at some point, there is localization. And then together with the localization, and this occurs, they argue that there's evolution to fractal particle size distribution, then there is localization, and together with the localization, there's evolution to velocity weakening. And that's it. From this point on, in most experiments, it remains localized. Some people made experiments with rotary shear, and rarely does it delocalize and go back. Once it localized, it's happy there. It works with higher mechanical efficiency. So what? This is summary now, and then we are done. So I'm arguing there is an initial phase of distributed deformation that is associated with creation of granularity. You start with a homogeneous rock, you create granularity, and you create some band-limited fractal structures at several hierarchies. But this deformation is very, very short-lived. Very, very short-lived. We usually don't see it. Now you see it in the lab, but if you go to the field and you look at these big faults, it occurred a long time ago. And then after very early on, when you get to peak stress, there is localization. And when the localization occurs, there is a transition to strain weakening, or slip weakening, or velocity weakening. And with this localization, the complex initial structure become mechanically quasi-passive or passive. And from that point on, what I showed you on different scales, it's not universal, I know, there's really difficulty with making those measurements, but what we see is that on different scales, from a scale of a single fracture surface to fault system, we see progressive evolution to geometrical simplicity and regularization. This table basically shows this sort of evolution on the different scales that I pointed out. That we first have evolution from some kind of homogeneous solid to granularity, and then quickly to some band-limited fractality, and then continuum Euclidean geometry. And that's all I wanted to show you, and because since you were so quiet, I will end with a few pictures, more pictures. This is a satellite picture of the San Andreas Fault. This is from Mike Reimer. This is the San Andreas Fault. That's the Gulf of California, Salton Sea, the Great Valley of California. This is the North American Plate and the Pacific Plate. You cannot see much on this scale, really. Here is a satellite map of the transverse range. So this is the San Andreas Fault, right here. And if I look really hard and spend a lot of time, I can even tell you where the punch bowl is. This is the current San Andreas, and the punch bowl might be this line right here. Here's another fault. This is the Galois fault.
Okay, that's how it looks.
What's the color code here?
The color is temperature. What?
No. Is it temperature?
I think so.
I think this is these false colors where chlorophyll is shown as comes out red. And,
So these are, this is a map I showed you at the beginning, just with names. These are all the names of the faults in Southern California. And you see the San Andreas here, San Jacinto, Elsinore, so on and so forth. So there is seismicity on all of them. If you look at, you know, network at the catalog, seismicity everywhere. This is the Eastern California shear zone that had the Landers earthquake.
Looks
very complex, right? Yeah. But
I was just going to point out that this is, I'm not sure that this is it, but it looks very similar. What's called the Holocene fault map, which is faults that have evidence of having slipped at the surface, in the last 100,000 years, say. And this may not be that map, but it has a comparable level of complexity.
Yeah.
To it. Yeah.
Right. And if you remember, I showed you several slides earlier, accurate locations of seismicity that sort of light up some of these portions of this network, right? We can go back to this if you want. Here is a similar picture for the Bay Area. So this is the San Andreas Fault. This is the Calaveras, right, Jim?
Yeah,
which one? Hayward.
Hayward.
The Hayward, so this is the Calaveras.
Right there.
The one in between.
This.
Yeah.
Okay, so I showed you before seismicity on the Calaveras. This is the Hayward Fault. Berkeley is sitting somewhere there on this fault. So that's how it looks like. But the biggest earthquakes, if you want to model, so when we do mechanical modeling, question is what is it that we want to model, right? Here's Parkfield. This is Parkfield, this is the main San Andreas Fault, this is the southwest fracture zone. If you look at accurate seismicity, the percentile distributions are sitting on both of those zones. And it appears to go to depths all the way. Most of the, earthquakes in the continental US looks very complicated. But anyway, my hypothesis is right here, that within this complexity, there is gradual evolution on the spines of those networks toward geometrical simplicity. And I'll stop here, and now I hope my job was to steer discussion, so now it's time to begin discussion.
Yehuda, can you go forward a couple of...
Forward?
Which
one?
That's good. I look at this picture, and I would agree with your view that these faults are evolving, but this is what we have to work with. And this is where the earthquakes...
For which question?
Well,
that's my point. This is what we have to work with. For which question?
For those of us that are interested in modeling earthquake activity.
But that's a very big title.
These faults are all active, let's say.
Yeah.
And we know from the seismicity map that you showed that there's a lot of earthquake activity. It may be small. There's a lot of earthquake activity is occurring on other faults that aren't even mapped.
Sure.
And occasionally those will pop off and give a slip of a meter or so. So there's significant earthquakes. And I look at that and I wonder, how can we build models of this system that captures kind of the essential physics of what's going on?
So,
and of course, we don't know what we can throw right now. I don't think we know what we can throw away to simplify the models to get somewhere, and we don't know what we're supposed to keep. But I think there are several problems. I'm leading up to a point. So I think there are several kind of research issues here, and one was touched on is how do we describe that kind of structure? There was some talk about, you know, characterizing fault networks. And I've made a point before here that it's difficult to do theory on an entity that you don't even know how to describe. And So I think that's just really a big outstanding problem.
I
appreciate hearing any ideas that people have.
One way of describing this is to say that the activity occurs at the boundaries of blocks. So you are talking with a blocky structure, granular medium, and that's the way the Southern California Earthquake Center, right, for example, are modeling some data.
You can say that
you have blocks of different size and the boundaries of the blocks. I'm not advocating this. I think, how do we describe this system depends on more specific, specific question that you are asking.
Right. Yeah. Let's just pursue that. The one big project's underway is to try to break Southern California up into blocks, bounded by faults where possible. If you look at this map, and let's say that we think magnitude 2 earthquakes, which is probably what's plotted on here, are important. And that's what's plotted on here. Now, how do we break Southern California up into blocks that will capture that activity? We're talking about a granular material, of some kind or something. That's one thing. The other one is something that's just permeated with fractures.
And another issue is...
And of different sizes and lengths.
And another issue, if you break this to blocks and you try now to move those blocks, you find out that the geometry is unstable. And this is why I'm working with dimensional change.
But can you go to the slide with Lochner's experiment with the acoustic emissions?
Oh.
There. Now, why can't we assume that basically the plates, millions of years in San Andreas, 6 million years old, now created, okay, and we have the plate boundary structure. So now we have the through-going fault. So if you keep squeezing on that, you generate, even after the through-going break here, you still generate a lot of stuff that's off. But the big slip, when it breaks, will go along that same break.
Yeah, that's the hypothesis that I actually tried to push.
See, I think that the big ones basically are going to be along a predefined plane, and you're always going to get these off things. But I think they're somewhat what Jim comes back, this Jim, that they're symptomatic of basically the stress level that is now being loaded onto the major player, let's say the San Andreas. So it's an indication perhaps of I don't know the problem is we don't know what level. We don't know if we're 80% because we get these events right
the
afterwards,
answer.
Or if we're 10% or 99%.
Are you suggesting that there's something in the three-dimensional structure that we don't see at the surface? That maybe what we're seeing at the surface is...
Well, the hypocenters will give us the three-dimensional. In other words, this distribution of hypocenters.
Is there any indication that there's any greater simplicity at depth? And you could imagine that
yes.
What's going on
yes.
is that there are just a few sort of maybe one fault at depth, and then because the surface produces the kinds of instabilities that I was talking about.
In some places...
When this stuff comes up and reaches the surface, it breaks up the surface.
In some places, we have evidence that this is exactly what happens, but in other places, we just see bands of seismicity going all the way to the bottom of the seismogenic zone. So it's not always the case.
Well, and we see them off the main faults.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
There are several main faults, so this bend of seismicity is some places.
Well, there's a clear example right now.
If you were to plot a map of California in which you plotted all the earthquakes from magnitude 1 to 2,
mm-hmm.
and then you were to plot a map 2 to 3,
yeah.
map 3 to 4, and so on and so forth, you would begin illuminating large areas and significant earthquakes occur at all depths off of the known
three-dimensional fault.
A three-dimensional, right.
Okay.
Yeah, my view is that
this
surface complexity may be greater, but not much.
Yeah.
The seismicity of each of those continue all the way to the bottom of the seismogenics, right?
Yeah.
So here it goes all the way to 15 kilometers.
Yeah.
And here it goes to 15 kilometers, etc.
Just in terms of relative importance, we've heard statements about most of the slip being of localized places. Can someone remind me, there's this the Gutenberg-Richter law says the probability goes like 1 over the magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
And the magnitude is the product of the slip distance and the area
of the slip?
It's the log of the, yeah, it's the log.
The
magnitude is the log of the slip multiplying the area. Okay. So it's a power law distribution. So
it's
between
sort of like energy.
But
log of the energy.
But should I think, so if I were to think of the slip distance times the area as being a one-dimensional thing, that is all of them extending down, then I would conclude that all magnitudes contribute equally to the actual slip distance. But if I have the other, if I include the fact that the small magnitude ones don't, well, if I say it's an area where it's a dimension squared, then I would get a different conclusion about whether I should care about the little ones or not. Right?
Of course.
Well, you know, there's a perfectly viable model, I believe, for Gutenberg-Richter, and that is that the earthquakes that occur define the segment size they're on, and, you know, plus or minus some amount. And so when you're looking at a Gutenberg-Richter distribution, you're also looking at a distribution of fault sizes. And that's a valid model, and it tends to hold up. You're not going to, the big earthquakes have to occur on the big faults, and they don't have that many small earthquakes.
Okay, Mark, on the map you see here, there are 20,000 points of this map.
How often
the faults
break, and you
have
to assume
how
large, enormous.
Well, I used to see a great complete model. The point I was getting at was to try to get at what is the distribution of fracture sizes in the earth that are working, and that are contributing to the seismicity, and it's from a hazard point of view, and if you're worried about energy budgets, the little faults don't count. But I'm not convinced by any means that argument carries through to kind of the mechanics of the system. Maybe the small scale is very important. And I happen to think it is, but
are there enough more of them that they contribute the same amount?
Well, they're part of the system. In what part? Throw it away.
There are many focal mechanisms here, just to clarify a little bit more the question that Mark is asking. So, different earthquakes have different focal mechanisms, and some earthquakes here reflect compression, some earthquakes here reflect extension, and some earthquakes reflect strike slip. The earthquakes that actually release the plate motion, the loading, in this area consists primarily of compression that produces the mountains here and strike slip motion. And if you look at the motion, the actual motion that is accommodated by a huge factor, almost all of the motion is on the biggest faults, the biggest 5-6 faults here. And all of these small events around are associated with small local motions that help small adjustments. Jim?
Yeah, but important, of course, as many have said, is important for what? If you wanted to look at accelerated moment release as a intermediate term precursor to big events, then of course all these little faults are very important. They're the ones that are giving the signal. If you want to look at the generation of high frequency seismic radiation during dynamic rupture, probably it is interaction with small branch structures, which is the source of a lot of that. Seismologists like to map that into strong heterogeneities of strength on planar faults, but in fact it might be activation of those branches, and indeed activation of the branch in general leads you with the heterogeneous normal stress on the fault, so both you sort of reinforce one another. And then if you want to try to infer things, as Jim Dietrich has done so successfully, if you want to try to infer things from aftershocks about what the largest likely event in an aftershock sequence is going to be, you need the little faults. So it depends on what.
Jim, nothing that you're saying precludes the idea that
it's the big faults that count if you want to be able to figure out what's going to happen, and the little ones are sort of slaved to that.
More or less.
I think all three of the possibilities you mentioned there.
Right. I would agree basically with that point of view you just expressed, but I would say a question mark hangs out there on whether some of this minor structure, like minor branches, whether they exert control over what rupture speed you see.
Yeah,
maybe we would routinely have super shear ruptures.
Because by the fact that these things...
One second. This gentleman wanted to say something, and then back to Dieter. Please,
I would like to share my feeling of this problem according to our experience in shocks and dynamics. Because, for instance, if shock pass in some characteristic volume, it's very difficult to restore the physical evolution of system due to the analysis of pattern, like in your case. And according to our experience, situation is the following. Geometrical complexity of fractality is a consequence of sharp change of this dropping of symmetry of the system due to the generation of collective modes of defense. For instance, shear localization area and damage localization area is quite different type of collective modes of defense. And these collective modes represents a new degrees of freedom of nonlinear system. Yes? And different type of self-similar solution correspond to shear localizations or damage localizations. It means that we have, in fact, two types of different attractors concerning collective modes, which is responsible for shear localization and damage localization. And since we have a different self-similar solution, or which corresponds the natural basis for spectrum analysis, it's possible to represent, for instance, signal from acoustic emission according to typical and more characteristic eigenforms. And in this case, I think this experimental data by Lochner is very, very interesting because it's data for different scales, and we have for smaller scales simplicity and complexity at higher scales. And according to my feeling and my experience, if we will represent this kind of the data in phase space of typical collective modes, spectrum analysis like wavelets, but it's not wavelets because wavelets not correspond to collective modes which are responsible for shear bending and damage localization. In this case, for different scales, we could have, for instance, for smaller scale, image of one attractor, like Poincaré cross-section. And at the higher scales, when damage localization area will appear, we will have the image of second attractor, which corresponds to damage localization area. And I will try to show this kind of the view due to the our study in my presentation.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. One thing to remember, unfortunately, in this problem, that the data are always extremely incomplete. For example, in the Lochner experiment, he estimates that only 1% of the actual acoustic emissions were recorded. And here, of course, if we put more sensors and we bury them deeper, we'll get more. And also there are errors. So the question is, I mean, it would be great to try some of these analysis techniques. Mm-hmm. But they have to be robust to incompleteness and errors as well. But I agree with your general message that there is some simplicity within...
The reason in acoustic emission is the following, that Fourier basis, it's not a natural basis for damage localization and shear localization. It's not possible to recognize image of the damage.
Okay. Jim and then Jay.
I was going to respond to Jim Langer, but he left. but I will make the point anyway. Jim's point was that well, maybe all the small earthquakes are just riding along.
What I call quasi-passive.
They're passively responding to big earthquakes, and that's possible. But I think a counter-argument can be made, and I've made it to Yehuda before, and that is that even faults that are essentially planar, but just have a waviness, say, of one part in 100, if you slide those faults, they'll induce a shear strain adjacent to the material of 1%. That's 10 times the breaking strength of the rock, or the shear strain, for fracture, typically of the rock. And so that off-fault damage may, I think, could have a big control on the actual sliding process itself. And we do see, even though it's attenuated on these worn faults, you do see roughness at all scales, and it's very pronounced at large scales, which you can see on this map. So the large slip, may really be dependent upon these smaller scale processes that are related to this fuzz on the diagram.
I agree.
I think it's something we need to straighten out.
The question is, I guess the question I try to address here is, so I refer to all of this as quasi-passive adjustments. I'm not saying there are not important adjustments. The question is the following. If you try to describe this system, where do you begin from? We can begin from a continuum Euclidean description and then add complexity to that and get the kind of feature that you are talking about. We can add geometrical irregularity and actually... we can do that. Or should we start, is this as a basic model, is it entirely wrong? And we actually have to begin altogether from some fractal description where we have roughness on all scale and then some quantities that we are used to work with become ill-defined. Or shall we begin actually working with blockiness? And that's sort of the question, but I agree with you that this, the geometrical character, regardless of what framework you work with, is going to be important.
Jay, I've got a question. Dynamic signal is more rich kinetic information.
It's more rich.
I keep thinking of, I think it was Tom Jordan's talk at the opening conference, that he's saying, okay, these maps were fine, and you showed all the little shocks and things, but it's the stresses that seem to be more important, and the fault that's not listed here or somewhere is the big one that he's expecting to rip. And
no.
There are no signals there.
There is signal. It's not true. There's geodetic signal.
But the fault is not in
the fault. The fault itself. Yeah. That's the sun on the side here. It's a little bit quiet. So but we see
kind of triggering off of this. If we had a better indication what the stresses were, I think that would be
stress. Strain. You can measure the strain accumulation with geodesy.
Yeah, but you can look at geodesy until you're blue in the face, and you won't see a fault in this. You're very lucky if you see a fault. The fault might be creeping along, but if it's not creeping, it's hard to find faults from strain observations.
But the GPS map.
What about this arc tangent? The famous arc tangent. You see this arc tangent, right? This is where the fault is from geodesy.
I see very smooth deformation fields from GPS.
Oh, okay, if you mean over 50 kilometer scale, but if you move beyond, say, 20 kilometers on either side of the fault, the GPS shows block-like motion that doesn't seem to know.
The GPS shows something like this, and actually, some analysis.
That width is a
the
weeds,
there's some papers in recent years by Budevonsky and Bork, etc. The weeds actually changes depending on where you are. In the basin, in the Big Bend, it's very, very broad. So if you have some geometrical, some complexity, geometry, it's complicated, you get very broad weeds. But I think in the Carrizo Plain, it's narrower, much narrower.
100 kilometers.
100? Okay, I thought it's less. I thought it's more like 10.
Well, the argument for more versus less was made for Northern California versus Southern California.
But even...
And the argument was that we were seeing a slow, diffusive spread of the viscous relaxation at depth. So it was narrow in the
profile that goes through point rays, but broader in itself.
That's another paper. They move in smaller segments along the fault and look at the weeds. But yeah, it's suddenly tens of kilometers. So the fault is somewhere there. So Jay, we see these kind of accumulation, right? But
you're only looking at strains from the time you started actually measuring. You don't really know what the stresses are that preceded that, so wouldn't...
Nobody ever measures stress. It's always strain measures.
Well, if you had the accumulation of strain, I guess you could kind of guess at the higher...
But it's only 15 years measurement.
Yehuda, would it affect any of your arguments at all if you, let's say, took out the aftershocks where, for example, Northridge and San Fernando, large stress drops, they generate... That's a large perturbation to the system, short time scale, and so you really stress the system, and maybe it has a reaction that is different from this very slow loading. If you didn't have the aftershocks in this picture, first of all, you'd see a lot fewer, and not only that, we'd never see very dense areas.
It would be simpler.
It would be simpler. Yes.
I agree, but we'll still get earthquakes in places that have geometrical complexities.
Right.
San Jacinto Fault, for example. There is ongoing seismicity near segment boundaries. But sure, this picture will become most of what we see are one form of aftershocks or the other, right? If you start counting for daughters and daughters and daughters, it's all aftershocks, actually. So yeah, it will be simpler. So if you are again only, if we were plotting only the largest 10 earthquakes in the last 50 years, picture will look dramatically different. There will be just a few points on just a few faults here, and that's it. Everything else would be empty.
And even as Ralph said, forget the largest 10, just throw out all the stuff that you know are aftershocks.
Yeah, but there is no clear definition. Okay.
And one theory is
seismicity
is every earthquake
yeah.
has any
aftershocks. Yeah, you see, seismicity, yeah, it's no, there is an operational definition of aftershocks, but everything is evolving, co-evolving.
Do you have to tell us what these colors are there too? Especially the ones with MPA on them.
All right.
I guess on this one, it's maybe location, accuracy.
No. The accuracy is the same in all of these. They try to estimate stress curves.
Stress curve.
And that's what you see.
And this is an MPA average stress drop per cluster?
For what?
The next slide. Good teasing us.
I'll give you the paper. I mean, they try to estimate stress drops, and then they try to look for correlation of the stress drop with some geophysical features, and they found none. But these are efforts to estimate the stress drops in the different earthquakes. If I had more time, I would pick an equivalent picture from the same group in which the color represents depths. But I didn't have the time, so.
But go back to this one with the MPA on it. I mean, they seem to be remarkably correlated.
Which one? This?
Space, yeah.
With what?
The clusters. But I mean, the very fact that there's any clustering at all according to the scheme.
Well, earthquakes are always clustered. So.
No, but they're clustered with
the
lower stress drop events seem to be clustered.
So is it simple or complex? What about here? Yeah, I mean, Jim, I don't know, maybe.
Look at long landers.
And long landers, there are regions that have different colors, I agree. But it's exactly the problem.
I see you
it's,
don't like the conclusion.
No, I do, but it's really the problem we are facing here, really, is what are we focusing on? We can always focus on some subscales here that suddenly we see boxes. What is this box? I don't know. So I tried to emphasize at the beginning that it's a complicated problem. We zoom in, I think what is fair is that we see the elements that I discussed at the beginning in all of those scales. Maybe not, maybe there is a better way of looking at all of this. I'd be very happy to hear about it. But we are really facing with the problem of what do we focus on? Okay? If you zoom out, we see all of this. If we zoom in, it turns out that in this region, actually, there are some very strange clusters of seismicity that have extremely anomalous geometrical shapes.
But there is a really good place to look on this particular map, and that is basically if you look here on the two branches of the San Andreas, okay, because you're completely in rock, you know, this is the place between, those two lower lines are between, right, this is the upper branch of the San, the lower branch and the upper branch of San Andreas when it goes through San Miguel Pass.
Right, there's nothing.
And there's nothing.
It's nice.
It's really nice that there's.
It's like the Acoustic Commission experiment. Everything in between.
Yes, and it's in between, and this is all granitic.
I agree. This is the San Andreas. This had several hundreds of kilometers of slip. These branches, and from paleoseismic trenching, we know that there were many large earthquakes on those faults. But there's no microseismicity, as you can see. So, So we didn't solve the problem today, but we see at least that there is a